We've been to all four corners of Britain in our quest to interview the great and good of entertainment. Comics, actors, writers, politicians, singers, dancers and choreographers. It doesn't matter who they are. They've all given me their own take on the world they live in and have, in their own way, helped to define what makes Britain great. So join me and my assistants as we get another insight into the marvellous and enigmatic world of showbiz here on Beyond the Title.
Journalist, broadcaster and cultural historian Matthew Sweet first came to prominence as the film and television critic for The Independent on Sunday before penning a repertoire of books surrounding the history of popular culture from silent movies to film noir. His BBC Radio 3 series, Free Thinking and Sound of Cinema, have made him one of the leading voices in factual radio. I caught up with a cultural academic to talk film, TV and recollections on a varied career within the arts. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Matthew Sweet.
Okay, right, so let's get going. Josh's first question. My first recollections of you was on cultural documentaries of the early noughties. How did these documentaries capture the mood of the time?
Wow, now I feel like a historical exhibit here. Tracking myself back to my origins. How do they reflect the time? Well, that's an interesting question, because I think if we're talking about, I don't know, one of the first things I did in television was The Culture Show, which was a kind of magazine program that would get to grips with whatever was going on at that moment right now. So we were always trying, I suppose, to capture something that was in the atmosphere, to try and work out what was happening with a very broad definition of culture. I can remember doing a film for them on etiquette and things like that. So actually, I've never really looked back at any of that stuff, but I imagine that sufficient time has elapsed now for that to form quite a good little time capsule of the early noughties. And I wonder what we would think of ourselves. Maybe we were a bit smug. I'm not sure. I can remember maybe we took ourselves too seriously. It was the kind of show where you'd be doing like a piece to camera in a field or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's something I can't quite answer, because I think in a way, you know, you do this work and then you don't really get to see it again. These days, I suppose things stay in circulation the longest, but stuff from the early noughties has kind of dropped down a bit of a hole in the back of the sofa, really. Mm. I never see that. The thing I see most often, actually, from that period is a series I did on the history of hotels for Channel 4. And Channel 4 kept that going, repeated that so often that people thought I'd made about 20 series of that, but they used to just stick it on if there was a gap between the John Mills film and Countdown. That's become a time capsule for me personally.
Yeah. So talking about sort of reflection and those kind of things, in 2012, you took part in the documentary The Many Faces of Ronnie Barker, which took an honest look at his life and career. How do you think the comedy landscape would have looked like if he had not retired so early?
Well, so that's a good question, because in a way, it's he went too soon, didn't he? But at the very end of his career, he clearly wasn't finding comic material that was quite good enough for him, was he? He did all those his own show, of course, with Ronnie Corbett, and he did Porridge and its sequel. But do you remember there was the very last thing he did as a sitcom performer was something called The Magnificent Evans, which was a series about a photographer in the Welsh Valleys. And it was just not very good. And I wonder whether, in a way, his decision to disappear at that point might have been quite a wise one. We'll never know, will we? There's a parallel universe where he stayed on and people wrote really great for things for him. But there might be an even worse one where he kept going with substandard material or material that wasn't resuited to him. What I really think that we genuinely missed, and I think he didn't do this because he perhaps wasn't confident enough about his own abilities, or he just wasn't that, he had nothing to prove, was like a bigger dramatic element to the end of his career. I mean, can you imagine like what Ronnie Barker doing Beckett would have been like? That would have been fantastic.
He did the Gathering Storm.
The Gathering Storm, absolutely. I mean, we could have had loads more of those, couldn't we? Because he's great in that, isn't he, as Churchill's butler. But he was very choosy. And maybe he just got fed up of it all. You know, maybe he just thought he'd done enough and decided he wanted to just sit down for a bit. I don't know whether he was that ambitious in a strange kind of way. It's odd, isn't it? We have these desires about the careers of people that might not always meet with their own feelings about themselves. You know, there are all kinds of people I wish had had these this sort of late period. You know, Ken Dodd went on performing till the very end. But I mean, wouldn't it have been great to see him in more dramatic roles? But people don't always do what you what you as a viewer want them to do.
Yeah. So back to sort of your career then. It's fair to say, or is it fair to say, I suppose, that you first came to prominence as a TV critic in The Independent?
Well, I got my first gig in journalism at The Independent. Yeah, I was a student then, really, and I went to open the post. And I was doing my DPhil at that time. So I still had a bit of the funding from that, which meant that I sort of had a little bit of money to live on, which meant that I could do unpaid work experience there. So I went to open the post, and you know, at the end of a couple of weeks there, I managed to get a commission or two. And it's just that that thing, if you just sort of sit there in somebody's eye line when they're in the middle of a crisis and they need something doing, sometimes they'll point at you and say, well, can you do that? And you'll say yes. So that's what it was, really. So I went there to open the post, and by the time I left there, which was probably kind of a good good 7 years of my life, I felt like I'd done every job on the paper. And it was also, I think, partly because the paper wasn't lavishly funded. It was struggling, rather. So anybody who was keen and cheap, they were willing to hear from.
How did sort of like a respectable broadsheet, I suppose, view the arts during that time?
Well, it covered them well, I think. It gave, when I think back to the kinds of things that we used to be asked to do for those pages, you know, interviews with quite kind of serious film directors, quite abstruse subjects sometimes. I look back and I think that would be a really hard. There was a little bit more money, so you would actually be sent out to report on something. I think one of the difficulties of arts journalism now, I mean, particularly now when we're all living this odd life, is being able to get out there and report on it. So there was space and time to do that. You know, they would kind of say yes to things that now I think would be harder to pitch to a paper.
Yeah. People like Gillian Reynolds, Eve Pollard, Polly Toynbee, they're some of the pioneers of entertainment journalism. How important do you think these figures are in the development of UK entertainment journalism?
Well, I think that, I mean, it goes way back before those great figures who you've mentioned. One of my biggest influences was a woman called Narina Shute, who I got to know when she was in her 90s. And she had been the gossip columnist on Film Weekly magazine in the late 20s, you know, still in the silent period. And I used to go around to talk to her about all of these people who had been, you know, had been dead for decades and nobody remembered who they were almost. And she told me about her times, you know, sneaking around the film studios and doing things like Alfred. She said Alfred Hitchcock had banned her from the set and she'd snook back on in disguise, this kind of thing. And actually, she was the person who I think I took the most guidance from. And she had this very clever technique of, if she was going to say something rude about somebody, she would always slip in a compliment at the same time. So so she would say that, for instance, a character actress of the period had a face like a delicious loaf of bread. You know, not a face like a loaf of bread, a face like a delicious loaf of bread. And it was those kind of things that, you know, that kind of thing made a big impression on me, really. And she was great. So people have been writing about the arts and about cinema in quite a sophisticated way, I think, for a very long time.
Yeah. Silent films, they're something that are special to you as well.
So are there silent films that are special to me? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I'm really grateful for is that I managed to get Faber to be interested in publishing a book about the early history of British cinema. At what felt like the very last moment it was possible to do that whilst there were still people alive who could give you their first-hand experiences of it. And so that was really the first couple of years of this century that I was writing that. So I was able to talk to people who had been in silent films, even to talk to people who'd been in films as far back as like 1912, 1913, which seems absolutely impossible, doesn't it? But I was able to speak to that tiny group of people who were then in their late 90s or just the other side of 100 in some of those cases, and get that really very spooky experience of reaching so far back in time through somebody's experience. I remember talking to a film star called Joan Morgan, who was a star in the teens and the 20s, and she made an adaptation made an adaptation of Thomas Hardy's The Mayor of Casterbridge, for which Thomas Hardy came on location with them. So, you know, there you are sitting in a room with somebody who can reach back all of those years to their memory of talking to one of the great Victorian novelists. And at moments like that, the deep past feels just within your grasp almost. So those kind of experiences I kind of crave, really.
So I want to ask you about BBC Radio 3's Free Thinking. Sort of discusses hard-hitting issues and things like that. How important do you think it is for programmes to tackle controversial subjects and talk about things on radio?
Well, I think one of the good things about this programme is that you can really talk about anything you want to on it, really. We cover all kinds of stuff. So we might do a program on Finnegan's Wake, you know, notoriously the most difficult novel in the language. And then the next week we might do a program about The Goodies, and we'll treat both of them with the same kind of seriousness and the same kind of intensity, really. But we'll also hopefully enjoy ourselves doing both of those things. So I think with Free Thinking, one of the things that I think is really important that we try to live up to the name of it. And if you've got that that title in the Radio Times each week, then it does make you think, well, what haven't we done, or how could we approach this question, or how can we tackle things that are, because we've got quite a lot of time. How can we tackle things in a bit more depth or from a different kind of angle? I mean, some of the things that we discuss are the things that you might hear discussed on the news channel or on the Today programme. But we try and investigate the ideas behind the story. So hopefully we're kind of fleshing things out a bit, putting them in their historical context, that kind of thing. For me, it's rather like never really leaving university, because all the time there's like a pile of books to read and people who I need to kind of do my homework in order not to look an idiot in front of when I talk to them. And it keeps you on your toes, really.
Yeah. So obviously you've had a few other radio ventures, sort of things like Memoirs of the Space Woman. And
oh, wow. Yeah. That was good. I enjoyed that. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you sort of maintain momentum when you're through radio?
Well, it's just a matter of you're always having to come up with new ideas, and then you have to try and get them onto the air. Now, if it's something that can go onto Free Thinking, that's a slightly more streamlined process, because there's a group of us who all the time are trying to come up with subjects for discussion. But if you want to do something a bit more elaborate than a kind of round table discussion, then you know, you have to pitch it, you have to get somebody to agree to let you do it and to fund it. For me as a presenter, you have to find a producer who wants to make something with you. And so that's and sometimes it's frustrating because the commissioner will not share your enthusiasm for a subject, and sometimes they do. So there's that sort of process goes on all the time, really. It can be a bit, you know, it can be a bit exhausting, but the thing is that if you have a good idea, it'll find its way out in some form, even if you know, the controller of a station doesn't say yes, absolutely, I want an hour on it in 2 weeks' time. There'll be space for it somewhere else. It'll, you know, once you've latched onto something, it's never, you know, nothing really, nothing's a waste of time. It all finds a home eventually.
Yeah. So looking back over your career, what do you think your proudest achievement is?
I don't know, really. It's I find it hard to even think of myself as somebody who has a career, because there's been so little structure to it. It feels like it might, you know, if you look at it, it might look like to you it has some sort of shape to it. To me, it's just like it's like the it's just kind of stumbling from one gig to another. They're very kind of everything's a one-off in a funny kind of way. Cool. But I think that the thing that satisfies me the most, really, is when you can share something with an audience who then respond to it. I mean, one of the things I really like doing the most is the film music program I do on Radio 3. Not just because I can sort of sit there and, you know, talking to film composers or kind of talking away to myself in this studio and playing the music, but it's the relationship with the listeners. And it's really blow me away, really. You know, I can kind of trail a question about what they think should be on next week's show, and we can get hundreds of responses. And what's good about it is that it shows that there would have been a time when you would have had to argue quite strongly that film music is serious enough to devote this kind of attention to. You know, nobody really did pay it much attention until relatively recently. And when Radio 3 did a big season of film music a few years ago, there was quite a lot of resistance to it. A lot of people said, oh, why are you doing this? You know, this isn't music. This is kind of incidental music, or this is sort of too, you know, this doesn't have a life beyond the experience of watching it in the cinema. But I don't think people make that argument anymore. And I say, one thing that really delights me is there's this big community of people who I'm now kind of plugged into who feel the same way.
Yeah. Excellent. So what's next for Matthew Sweet? What have you got coming up? And have you got any other projects or anything at the same time as the radio?
Yeah, well, I'm always on the lookout for things. Are in a weird kind of hiatus now. I should be in Vietnam at the moment, where I have had a project set up there for the summer. A gallery installation that was a sort of had a kind of history dimension to it, but which was a project about about radio during the war in Vietnam. And I'd been out there and I'd, you know, interviewed people who were involved, and together with a Vietnamese sound artist called Nung Nguyen and a British filmmaker called Esther Johnson, we were making this gallery piece which would have filled your head with all of these strange kind of radio artifacts, and there's images to go with it. And it's going to happen, but like next year, we hope. Yeah. So that's what, that's what I should be doing now. And I'm also, I've got really into having visiting it to give some talks there. I've become deeply interested in all things Vietnamese. So I've got a couple of other things I'd like to pursue there, sort of history projects, really, looking back to the 60s and 70s. But who knows? I mean, there are no, you can't fly to Vietnam right now. Even if I could get there, even if I walked there, I would have to quarantine for 14 days. So everything is on hold at the moment.
A little bit. Sounds fascinating. Hmm. Okay, that's all the questions that Josh has got for you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you to our guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title interview. If you liked this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else that takes your fancy? Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews and to see more information about me and what I do. Thanks again, and hopefully see you next time.